Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Martin Amis, whose latest novel is Lionel Asbo, State of England. Earlier novels include Yellow Dog, House of Meetings, The Pregnant Widow, nonfiction Cobra the Dread, The Second Plane. Martin Amis, in an interview in The Telegraph, you said that each novel has to find its own form, and the process of writing begins with a pang, a situation, a character that seems to go off like a solar flare. So you think, I can write a novel about this. What was that solar flare for Lionel Asbo?
It was a dual flare. And as so often, it's something you see in the newspapers or over here. But in this case, I saw in an agony column in a very rough British tabloid that a young boy was writing in to say that he was having an affair with his grandmother. That was one thing. And the other thing was a report about a terrible act of revenge where someone had allowed his pit bull dogs, had allowed them access to the baby daughter of his enemy with sanguinary results. It didn't take long to discover how to connect the two things.
It seemed to me, as I was reading the novel, that the character of Lionel Asbo, easily one of the most disgusting human beings I've ever read about, this vile individual who was actually vile at the age of three and continued to get worse, it felt as if he arrived fully formed. Is that correct?
Yeah, he did. You must admit, though, he's got a certain charm.
The kind of charm that you want to read about but never want to meet.
Well, that's right, and that's what fiction is. It's someone said the covers of a novel are like the bars of a cage, and you can enjoy looking at the reptile without feeling threatened. But his speech, which is so important in the novel, took a while to refine, but his drives and his values were certainly fully formed when I began.
The character itself, not the speech, but the guy behind it, the reptilian brain behind it. At what point, when you connected these dots, did you realize that behind this would be the man who would be the center, not the protagonist, but the center of the piece? And then death comes afterward, I would guess.
Well, he's the little boy who's having an affair with his grandmother, who, by the way, is only 24 years older than him. Such being the sort of the demographic of where he lives, this imaginary borough of East London. You know, some things about writing novels are very crude and obvious, and having created Lionel, an exceptionally repellent character in many ways, although the sort of guy you like to see on the page, you know, you sort of cheer up when he appears because you don't know what he's going to do next. But he is close, and towards the end, very close to pure evil, which meant that the other character, who's his nephew, Desmond, had to be implausibly good. And it's much harder to do the goodies than the baddies.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think a great law of literature. As Henri de Montalon said, happiness and goodness write white. The words don't show up on the page. Dickens, who loomed over this novel for me, all the energy in Dickens goes into the frumps and vamps and villains and eccentrics and misers, etc. And there's nothing left but a kind of sentimental wishfulness for the good characters. And they're all faceless and bodiless and interchangeable.
So to that extent, Des is Oliver Twist and Lionel is Fagin.
Yeah. I realized how Dickensian this novel was towards the end. I mean, I thought of him mainly as for his furniture and atmosphere of London. But Dickens is a fascinating case because everyone knew at once that he was a great writer. But it took a century before they realized that he was a serious writer. And the reason for that is he's not a social realist in the mold of George Eliot and Trollope, etc. He deals in a kind of fairy tale world, a world of sort of magical transformations and parental mysteries. And it's a sort of nursery rhyme, fairy tale kind of genre. Has more in common with the Disney cartoon than with the social realist novel. And I realized that my novel, too, has elements of fairy tale. Huge rewards, huge punishments, and little miracles and implausibilities, but realistic.
Well, you don't have the coincidence that he has.
No, I don't depend on coincidence quite the way he does.
Martin Amis, what relation does Lionel have to an earlier character of yours, John Self of Money?
There's a sort of whole line of these characters in my stuff. There's John Self, Keith Tallant, Clint Smoker, and now Lionel Asbo. You'll notice that the names of the characters suggest a certain heightened, stylized approach to reality. All my life I've known people not unlike those characters. I've always been charmed by them and find that they're, in fact, very articulate and expressive and vivid. And also, it seems to me, possessors of a kind of thwarted intelligence. If you're intelligent and your intelligence is never encouraged or brought out, never developed, you come to value stupidity and think, to hell with intelligence, I'll be stupid. You think I'm stupid, I'll be stupid. And as Desmond says of Lionel, that he seemed to give being stupid a lot of very intelligent thought.
Well, there's a lot of question in the book as to whether Lionel Asbo is intelligent or stupid. A lot of question about that. You once said that this is a book about intelligence, how it's used, developed, and wasted, and that our values tend to point the other way. And as an example, you give The Reality Show.
Yeah, yeah. The Reality Show is a kind of celebration of stupidity, I think. It's, as Marxists say, no accident that Lionel comes close to going on a program called I'm a Celebrity, What the Am I Doing Here? I'm a Superstar. And it's to do with that whole vein of tabloidal life, which is much stronger in England than it is here, where there is this population of people who are famous for being famous. I do think that fame has become the new religion in England, not so much in America, because there's still a lot of religion. And people regard fame as a sort of civil right, and that it's considered a deprivation to be obscure.
Do you think that has something to do with the fact that the royal family, through the hundreds of years, have always been celebrities, where in America it took a long time for that sort of thing to happen? I mean, we have the Kardashians, who are only famous for being famous.
That's actually a very good point about the royal family, and never occurred to me before. But they're all famous for being famous. I read some account of the Queen's life, where they used to take the pram out and the famous baby would be photographed. I mean, how can a baby be famous? It's obviously not for anything the baby's achieved. So they set, a kind of national example of fame being conferred by something other than ability or distinction.
Well, when you're writing this novel, Martin Amis, and you have this fully formed character of Lionel, in that first draft, because I know there were two drafts that were quite different, did he surprise you at all? Were there any surprises along the way, or did you feel so in control of what was going on that he was more your pawn?
The question of control is an interesting one. Ian Foster used to line up his characters and say, right, no larks. Nabokov, in contrast, said that, he said, it was in a radio interview, he said, my characters cringe when I come near. I have seen whole avenues of imagined trees lose their leaves in terror as I approach. So he never lets them get out of line at all. But I posited that Lionel is a very unpredictable guy, and that's dangerous. It's fun because they surprise even you. But a character who's consistently unpredictable becomes incoherent. Don DeLillo has always said and dramatized the fact that the novel tends to overstress the role of motivation in human affairs, and that motivation is actually now quite a weak force. People are influenced by things that you couldn't call motives. But the danger there is if a character is motiveless, it's like writing about a crazy person. It's incoherent. Motivation tends to promote coherence, and that's what you want. So it was a fine line of every time he came onto the page, I wasn't quite clear what he was going to do, but it had to be some sort of rationale for his behavior.
So that meant at some level that Desmond had to always walk a very straight path so that he could react to Desmond rather than just go off on his own.
Yeah, Desmond is, as I said, almost a saintly figure. This creates a lot of subconscious hostility in Lionel. There's a line in Othello that kept occurring to me. when Iago is trying to provide himself in a soliloquy with a motive for his malevolence. And he's actually referring to Cassio at this point, but it would do for Othello. He says, "He hath a daily beauty in his life that makes me ugly." When Lionel looks at Desmond, he feels that, I think.
And that also creates for you the ability to have him react up against Desmond.
Yeah.
You've said also in an interview, in that interview in the Telegraph, that when you finished Lionel Asbo, you had written very happily for a year and then revised miserably for another year, and you realized the problem was something to do with anxiety. Can you talk a little about that?
I said to Edward St. Aubyn, fellow writer, he said, "What did you put into it that wasn't there?" And I said, "A year's worth of anxiety." Writing fiction comes out of almost a 50-50 symbiosis of pleasure, elation, and anxiety. If it's all elation, the novel's not going to be any good. And if it's all anxiety, it's not going to be any good either.
Why?
You have to sort of earn the novel. Especially when you're writing about violence and very rebarbative things. You can't just state it. You have to sort of go through some suffering in your study. And we all know what that is. It's when the words are all heavy and won't obey you, and you come to a scene and it's all dead and you have to create it ex nihilo. So I had to put in the suffering. A spectacular example of that was the novel House of Meetings, which is about the Gulag. And I wrote it in Uruguay, surrounded by the South Atlantic and with my beautiful wife and beautiful daughters and a life without stress. And I had to put in the suffering, and the only way I know how, I couldn't go to the gulag, so I had to have a sort of torture chamber for a study for a while. And then when you've reached a point where you think, all this novel is terrible and all my other novels are terrible, then it starts, you've hit bottom and you start to buoy up again. And I've gone through that process many times. But it still horrifies you every time.
The anxiety and the torture, was that having to do with, as you said, the rewriting of Lionel's voice?
No, that was all pleasure, and it was just a matter of refining that. No, it was a terrible thing happens about a quarter of the way through the novel. A young boy disappears, thanks to Lionel. And I found that I hadn't weighed that. I hadn't registered the weight of that. And it was very crucial. And I take comfort from the fact that Nabokov spent a whole month on a single sentence of Lolita. It's a very pertinent sentence, but it's not one of the most memorable by any means. And yet, you know, it's nice to know that even he, who was monstrously productive, that he too came up against these difficulties.
What was the difference between that earlier version and the later version where you gave it weight?
I had to develop a whole new relationship, which was between the parents of the disappeared boy and Desmond. But it took a long time to see that that was the way through that. That was the crux, and then thereafter it was all just, you know, if you write fast and happily, it's all very perfunctory. You're enjoying the speed of it all and the developments and the plot. So you think, well, I'll fix that later. And it was all like that. It all had to be fixed later.
When you're polishing the writing on the later drafts, is that pretty much the same? I mean, when you're sculpting the sentences, I mean, does that change book to book, you think?
Not really. Well, you know, one of the things that happens to you with age is that, you know, if for convenience sake, I wrote an essay about Nabokov where I said, let's divide his gift into what derives from genius and what derives from talent. And the great secret of Nabokov, everyone knows he had tons of genius, but he also had tons of talent. His transitions, his modulations, all the bread and butter stuff, he does wonderfully. And I've noticed that every writer has a bit of genius and a bit of talent. That the genius stuff, the God-given stuff, the music, if you like, gets a bit weaker, and the craft, the technique, gets stronger. So I've noticed that.
That's very true with in sports figures as well. As they get older, they lose their reflexes, but they make up for it with what they've learned.
Yeah, and that 38-year-old, 40-year-old French midfielder in the European Cup, who controlled all the matches he played He wasn't fast anymore, but he had what they call the football brain.
You're listening to an interview with Martin Amis, whose latest novel is Lionel Asbo, State of England. I'm Richard Walensky. Asbo is not his real last name. It's Pepperdine. But he takes the name Asbo as the antisocial behavior order, which is...
It's like being on probation. He changes his name by deed poll at the age of 18 to Asbo. I just like the aggression of that. And as Desmond said, you know, if you spend half your life in court, isn't it a bit daft to change your name to Asbo? It's like proclaiming that you're a criminal. And I thought that was just the sort of thing that Lionel would do.
The subtitle is State of England, which is, I guess, in a way, what the novel is about.
There used to be a subgenre called State of England novels in England, which were very earnest novels of ideas with lots of dialogue and everyone sounding the same, analyzing the institutions of England and taking its temperature, so to speak. My novel is sort of almost the opposite of that. There's no social analysis, but there's sort of dramatized social analysis. And it was a glance at that. My then 12-year-old daughter said, when this was being discussed at the dinner table, said, with real passion, she said, "Enough with the subtitles, Daddy, for crying out loud." And I sometimes think she was on to something. Here, it hasn't caused any trouble, but when the book came out in England, there was a pronounced touchiness about the subtitle.
That brings to mind, you know, the question, what is a novel about? And if you're kind of sort of indicating that, you said, again, in that interview, that you didn't know what Pregnant Widow was about when you started writing it. Did you really know what Lionel Asbo was about?
No. I mean, for several years, I had two other novelists in the house, my father, Kingsley Amis, and my stepmother, Elizabeth Jane Howard. And she said to me once that she said, I can't start a novel until I can say what it's about on the back of an envelope. Now, I'm not at all like that, but by the time you're seven-eighths of the way through a novel, you could write it on the back of an envelope. It's very good to have that single-sentence explanation of the novel, because when you're cutting and something strikes you as not up to scratch, and you think, well, is it to do with that single sentence? And if it isn't, you cut it. If it is, you don't. I still couldn't write it in a single sentence, but I knew it was to do with intelligence. You know, his mother dies from a hematoma to the brain. His uncle Ringo says no brainer. There's a lot of incidental imagery to do with brains and minds, and I knew that single sentence explanation would include the word brain.
It also has a strange moment in the book where we reach the present day and we go beyond, and there's really no reason to do that. Why did you do that?
Go into 2013.
Yeah.
To go into the unknown. And it's the most violent bit of the book. I thought it just felt right to me. I mean, half the decisions you make are all dictated by the subconscious. They feel right and just instinctively fall in with them.
Someone suggested that Distin means dystopia, Distin being the place. Was that pretty?
Yeah, and in early drafts it was spelled D-Y-S-T-O-N, and I thought that was too fancy for Distin, so I changed it.
It reminded me that this Distin place, he has to walk up 33 flights or something to get to his apartment, Des does. It reminded me, in a way, of two movies from England. One is Shaun of the Dead, which is about zombies, and the other is a movie which almost seems to take place in Distin called Attack the Block. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
It's about an alien invasion in a place similar to Distin.
Ah, so they both have the supernatural in them. I could see from my window for many years what's known as the ugliest high-rise in London, and it's in fact a scheduled building now because it's such a perfect example of the new brutalism. It's already featured in my novels. Again, it's a fairy tale image too, the tower, you know, it's a part of the repertoire of the fairy tale.
You mentioned this before about the celebrity culture, the Murdochization of the world, as exemplified by a character named Threnody, who is a groupie who seeks fame, that has spread to America. What does that say, do you think, about the nature of our civilization and where it's going?
To talk about Murdoch just for a minute, I think it's a kind of red herring, really, the fact that he's been hacking into celebrities' phones. As a friend of mine wrote in The Guardian, columnist, she said, these stories that he's addicted the British public to would be highly deplorable even if they were delivered by the stork. It's not how you get them, it's what they are. And the whole tenor of it is a sort of giggly scurrilousness and always attributing the worst motives. He's cynical, and he assumes everyone else is cynical. And who'd be a cynic, you know, condemned to see cynicism everywhere, which is what a cynic is. It's the general coarsening of the imaginative life. In fact, I think he has done some damage to the English character, but the English character is much more generous than he thinks, much more tolerant and witty and generous. And the most spectacular example of that, of the press in general, was when Princess Diana died, and there was this great upswelling of almost millennial sentimentality about this, in fact, pretty undistinguished but famous for no reason person. The tabloids were putting representations of Diana on the front page as an angel with a little crown and all that in heaven. And as Don DeLillo said in White Noise, heaven, it turns out, it's always partly cloudy in heaven. They put that on the front page while wrenching out of the center pages stories about what a slut she is and what a, you know, feckless, worthless young woman. And they didn't sense that there was going to be this massive sense of that she was one of us and that she was highly valued. The Murdoch story and the tabloid culture in general is the triumph, or the partial triumph, of cynicism over the decent feelings of most of the populace.
How does that play into the decline and fall of, say, first Britain and then America?
It's not clear that America is declining. It's very hard to measure decline. It's certainly losing influence. In real power, it's still the hegemon. For instance, the gridlock in Congress has very much damaged America's image abroad. I agree with the writer Robert Kagan, who's just published a good short book called The World America Made, that American hegemony has been a force for good. No major wars between the great powers since 1945. America's gravitational example has meant that the number of democracies has increased by a factor of 10 almost since the Second World War.
But then we've still got the dictatorships through the Middle East, we've still got Vietnam, we've still got Iraq.
And also Neil Ferguson, historian, has said that in fact since the Second World War the battlefield has moved south, particularly to Africa, and there have been, according to him, there have been 20 million deaths through proxy wars. And anti-Americanism is rife in Europe, but I would like to know how they're going to feel once China emerges, because the gravitational example there will be a statist and authoritarian society and not a democratic one. And that will have effects that can't be good.
And that's the only alternative at this point?
Well, they say the rise of the rest. China, the great hulk of the Chinese economy, is due to overtake America's in about 2045, so it will have been exactly the American century. The standard of living in China will still only be on the level of Slovenia or Greece, and at the moment it's at African levels almost. But they will have that power and no doubt a sort of a military presence to match.
The proxy wars that have been going on have led to some horrific events on the part of America's proxies. Who propped up Saddam Hussein? Who propped up Noriega? I mean, you're also looking at a lot of payback here.
Yeah, well, Steven Pinker, in his book The Better Angels of Our Nature, said that, in fact, world violence started to decline markedly in 1945. And Robert Kagan says the coincidence eludes him, but shouldn't elude us, that this was when America emerged as the main world power. You know, the figures show that it's the wars between the great powers that are massively destructive. I wouldn't for a moment say that Cambodia is what Kissinger called it, a sideshow. But they are not the great conflicts that ruined continents.
Martin Amis, you went to the Republican National Convention, wrote about it for the Daily Beast. I love this. You said, Ron Paul and Paul Ryan are anti-abortion libertarians who managed to distill a few predatory slogans from Ayn Rand's unreadable novel, Atlas Shrugged.
Yeah, they have other things in common, too. Yeah, it was a pretty grim experience. The level of articulacy was miserable down there. And it's amazing that the Republicans have come up with a nominee and a VP pick, both of whom are all thumbs with a simple declarative sentence. Their sentences start well enough and then go to hell. You know, Romney, he said things like, with Ann and I, he said things like, the sunshine is out. He can't talk. I attacked his religion in the piece, and I know that's considered ungallant in America, but it is. It's a pitiful religion, and embarrassingly recent to 1830, not 40 centuries ago like Judaism. And it makes him hopelessly provincial, apart from anything else. When he went to Jerusalem and was disgracing himself there, having disgraced himself in London, which takes some doing for an American politician, and there he was sitting next to Sheldon Adelson. You know, you'd have to rack your brains to come up with someone more disreputable, or as disreputable as a casino billionaire who's being investigated on a dozen fronts.
He's apparently trying to turn Macau into the next Vegas.
Yeah, and he's looking for Romney's help on that. If Romney had had Larry Flynt sitting on the other side of him, that would have been all of a piece. $25,000 plate fundraiser in the King David Hotel, itself the scene of a historic terrorist atrocity, and him talking about Jerusalem being the capital of... He's ridiculous when he's not in America, Romney, because his imagination has never had to deal with the world before. He's not just tone-deaf, he's world-deaf. And how can he stride about Jerusalem and try and talk sense when he believes that the Garden of Eden was located in Missouri? I also said that he failed in Tampa to answer the question that all America is asking is Mitt the kind of guy you'd like to have a glass of water with? He's the second Republican running with whom you can't have a glass of beer. In Bush's case, it was because he's a dry drunk. But he was elected, Bush was elected and re-elected on that principle that you could have a glass of beer with him. Well, you can't have one with Romney.
The 47% solution.
Well, that was tremendously revealing because it was country club talk. The sort of talk you do among your peers in a country club. But it's also the words of a country club bore as well. I mean, what could be cornier and more stock response than that sort of givers and takers, takers and makers? In Tampa, there was a lot of quite effective sob stuff about what a philanthropist Romney is. And that story about how he mentored a 12-year-old boy who was dying and helped him get his affairs in order. I mean, that is very impressive, I'm sure, true, too. So we thought he had a heart, but those were very heartless remarks and reinforced the impression that Romney is on the crest of a kind of corporatist takeover of America and that terrible ruling by the super PACs. And the level of dishonesty in this election is staggering. The Republicans clearly planned a pincer movement where they would buy the election while also stealing it with voter suppression and gerrymandering and just telling a pack of lies and not worrying about the consequences. I think that's going to undo them, actually.
What's the difference between, say, how a British aristocratic family would speak and a Romney?
I once asked my father about what class we were, and I said, are we nouveau riche? And he said, well, very nouveau and not at all riche. Romney is not nouveau riche, is he exactly? He's sort of second generation. He has a sort of cultureless face. He has the face of someone who seriously believes he's going to live forever. You know, the Mormon heaven is very competitive, so he's obviously looking forward to doing wonderfully well there. But, you know, awareness of mortality is what ages us. It scribbles all over the orbits of your eyes and the brow, makes your hair fall out, Romney, when he was a young man, looked like a young porno star, and now he's older, he looks like an old porno star. He has a sort of time-proof face, a sort of waxy time-proof face that comes from tremendous complacency about his past and his future in heaven.
I'd like to ask a couple of questions about Christopher Hitchens. I've interviewed you before. I've interviewed several of your friends, a circle of people, Ian McEwan, Salman Rushdie, a few others. And I was going to interview Hitch. In fact, the tour was on, and then he
was diagnosed.
Yeah. He was diagnosed, and that was the end of the tour, and I never got a chance. But I know that he, up until his last breath virtually, he was very involved in what was going on in the world. How did he look at that point in America? And also, you know, I once asked you, I said, you know, it seems like he's changed. This was after 2001. You said, no, he's the same old guy. He hasn't. He's the same person.
Well, everyone said he turned to the right and became a neocon. He did admit that he sort of hitched his wagon to that because he believed in the Iraq War. I never did, and wrote a piece in March 2003 predicting more or less what's happened. We never argued about it. Well, we argued about it, but never heatedly. And I said just before we were going into Iraq, we were on the phone, he said, what is still bothering you about it? And I said, allocation of resources, the fight against Al-Qaeda was still very hot, and legitimacy. I said, you know, there's a rule of war that doesn't work out here, that if you're going to have not just an adventurous war, but an experimental war, which is what it was, you have to be pretty certain you're going to make things better, and very certain you're not going to make them worse. And it couldn't satisfy those two. And he was aware of the legitimacy question, and very aware of it when the weapons weren't found. It's interesting to read today that 3 out of 4 Republicans think that we did find weapons of mass destruction. So perception rules all. But I think he was basically a street-fighting lefty, and that leftism, as we see now in the Occupy protests, is dead. That sort of fiery, hot, lefty, Trotskyist, he always used to say, only Stalinists call us Trotskyites. We should be called Trotskyists. That is dead in America. That whole youthful heat is gone. And he was looking, as he always looked, he's sort of looking for trouble, and he thought that this was, he said to me, a marvelous adventure. But I think it was still that same radical revolutionary feeling that made him back the Iraq idea that you could reshape the Middle East and implant democracy.
But there were two flaws. One, there was no end game, no exit strategy was one flaw, which you kind of talk about. The other flaw is if your house is falling down and you hire a contractor, you don't hire one who's going to make it worse. George W. Bush could not do anything right. We knew that.
Yes, he hired the Good Intentions Paving Company. What was very terrible to see, I thought, was how little internal protection Bush had against the venom of power, the corrupting. Power corrupts. That's not a metaphor. That really happens. And that's why you have a political class where you train people to be immune to it. And I think that's the least touted of Obama's virtues, is how incredibly calm he is in the face of power. Power has a sobering effect on him, unlike Romney, who when he managed to sort of squeeze out those victories, remember he succeeded in trailing Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, Rick Perry, and Herman Cain. Even they were too much for him. But when he started to win, he looked like Dan Quayle looked when he was yanked out of the French Quarter in New Orleans and told he was going to be the next vice president of America, and he looked like someone who'd just done a gram of coke. And that's how Romney looks. He has no protection against it. And remember Bush, mission accomplished, the saluting, the way he stuck his chest out, and it was horrible to see. We don't go to Hitch for common sense. We don't go to his books for that. There's plenty of common sense around. You know, millions of people can do common sense. He did intellectual drama, and that's why he was loved.
Did he ever talk toward his latter days about those days in particular when he was kind of anathema to the left?
No, he didn't. He talks about it in his memoir, Hitch 32, right. And there's a 30-page section where he doesn't give an inch on Iraq. But that was his nature, and it's an element of his bravery, too. And he was always recklessly brave, and many occasions we'd be in some desperate pub underneath Piccadilly Circus and confronted with these sort of troglodytic characters, and I'd say, you know, discretion is the better part of valor. Come on, Hitch, let's leave. And he never would. And he would stand there, and he wouldn't back down an inch, and he got beaten up on the streets of Beirut just 2 years before he died for scrawling obscenities on a fascist poster, and very nearly got kidnapped. Was an inch away from it. It was just part of his courage, and his courage was very evident as he was dying. His unfailing good manners and courtesy, as in these various hospitals, you'd be sitting with him, and every 10 minutes someone would come in and do something unspeakable to him. He could take it. Also, brave in the sense that he was never ashamed. I think it must be very difficult when you're ill and your illness is so visible, and he was so ill, he was so sick, not to want to cringe and hide. He had his head up all the time, and that comes from a deep core of bravery.
He also, up until the end, was still writing furiously, wasn't he?
Yeah. You know, a typical hour with him would... He never wanted to talk about his illness. So he would talk about, you know, Islam, Germany, the roots of anti-Semitism in France, etc., etc. Very wide-ranging, very, very keen and eager. That was what pained him most, was when his voice was... His vocal cords weren't working. And his voice, which was a perfect voice, and I think great ingredient of his charisma, together with his looks, he felt that really was his lifeblood that was being taken away from him, because he loves to argue and loves to talk.
You miss him.
Yeah, but that's been paradoxical, because it was an absolute catastrophe when he died, but he always had, I thought, a very enviable love of life. And I'd like to think, too, he loved life so much that he never went to sleep. And in fact, he didn't die at 62. He was about 72, if you count how long he's been awake. But his love of life, he seems to, so far, and touch wood, and I'm sure I'm going to get depressed in a month or two, but he seems to bequeath that love of life to me, and perhaps to other of his friends. And I hope that's a universal thing, that this is what our dead friends give us.
Do you think he's also bequeathed a little pugnaciousness to you now? Do you feel more free to just be whatever?
The only change I've noticed politically is that I can no longer be bothered to disapprove very much of the royal family in England. They help the ethnic rainbow. They give, every now and then, they give England a holiday from rationality, which is totally benign. Any other country, if everyone went mad, you know, once every few years, there wouldn't be an unbroken window or an unraped virgin left in the country. But in England, all you get is this sort of sappy happiness. Hitch would be down on me like a ton of bricks if he heard me saying this. So that's the only liberation I feel so far.
One final question about him. Did he ever talk about what was happening with the euro and what he thought about that?
There's a very prescient essay in his book, arguably, where he says he was asked to nominate a holy cow and attack it. My father was asked to do something like that, and he chose the American novel. And he said, how long is the piece meant to be? And they said 900 words. He said, well, I don't think I'll need that much. But Hitch nominated as his sacred cow the euro, and said this is a totally artificial notion that is doomed. And he wrote that in sort of 2003.
Martin Amis, I understand your next novel is your, quote, second visit to the Holocaust. What's that?
It's a short, realistic novel. My first visit was so tortuous, and I just felt I had, because I did it backwards in time, and that was the only way I could approach it, I think.
Time's arrow.
This time I'm going to go there, you know, sort of more head-on. You know, having taken the quite momentous decision for me of writing again about it, because there are many people I respect who say you shouldn't write fiction about the Holocaust, that is its exceptionalism, in fact. George Steiner, Cynthia Ozick, and others. Having made the decision, I decided that I would not deny myself any of the things I do as a novelist. One of the main characters is the commandant of an unnamed concentration camp. And he is going to get, you know, the most bitter mockery I can summon. So I'm not going to be inhibited. I'm, you know, having chosen to go there, I am going to, you know, give it all I can.
How's the anxiety level of this one?
Not too bad so far, and I'm sure I'll have to go through murder to actually bring it off.
In terms of your journalism, do you plan to write more about the election?
Yeah, I imagine I will be, yeah. Having become a resident of America, I find I'm very viscerally involved with this election. I know this would not go down well in Tennessee, but I would, since America is the leader of the world, I would ask Americans to consider how the world would vote. The world has an interest in this election. In the whole of Europe, I don't think you'd find more than a few dozen people who would vote for Romney.
Martin Amis, any word from Hollywood on any of your novels lately?
They've been trying to make London Fields for a very long time, and I think that might be inching closer. But it's idle to put any hope and trust into that. And anyway, I wouldn't feel at all protective of the novel, because the novel, if they did make it, because the novel is still there. The trouble with my stuff is that all the roles should be played by Gary Oldman, who would be the perfect Lionel Asbo, but alas, he's a little bit old, because Lionel is only 23.
But he could look 60.
He could look 60, yeah. People age very quickly in distant town.
You've been listening to an interview with Martin Amis, whose latest novel is Lionel Asbo, State of England. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.